Hi, I'm Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. In the near future, Congress is expected to consider a major criminal justice reform package. The killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis last month has generated a lot of interest over this bill. Floyd died after a police officer was seen on video with his knee on Floyd's neck for almost 9 minutes. What are some of the key elements of this legislation, and will Republicans and Democrats be able to work out their differences on this bill in the coming weeks? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Senator Patrick Leahy. Senator, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Well, thank you, and I enjoyed being able to hear some of the governor's press conference before we came on.
And Senator Leahy joins us from his office in Washington, D.C. Senator, you're the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. This legislation seems like it's going to need some bipartisan support if it's going to become law. Right now, as of today, the Democrats are threatening to block consideration of the bill because it's not strong enough. So briefly tell us, what are the provisions that you want in the bill that the Republicans are objecting to?
Well, it's more the way it's been done. The bill has been blocked in the last few minutes by a vote, but I think that's just a starting point. I met this morning with the Republican chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. We were talking about what we did when I was chairman. We had an immigration bill. We had several weeks of hearings, and we went into late at night on markups. We looked at several hundred votes and several hundred amendments, rather. And we vote them up or down, and both Republican and Democratic amendments. As a result, we had a bill that passed 2-1 in the U.S. Senate, Republicans and Democrats voting for it. It didn't become law because the then Republican Speaker of the House would not bring it up. Later admitted that was a bad mistake. I suggested, and he agrees with me, let's do that in this. We have a lot of people, Republicans and Democrats, on the Judiciary Committee who know a lot about law enforcement. A number of us have been former prosecutors. And instead of giving us a take-it-or-leave-it bill that's been written solely in Mitch McConnell's office and it comes across really too partisan, do it this way where both bodies and both parties in the Senate vote on it, debate it, and then bring it forward, and then vote it up or down. And I think that at least the Republicans I've talked with this morning agree with me quietly that's what should be done. Because in something this important, with race relations, major changes in law enforcement, it's not going to be done as an all-Democratic bill or all-Republican bill. It's going to be a bipartisan American bill.
Well, Senator, are the Democrats, let's say you go down this route and you're able to get the opportunity to offer some amendments, some may be accepted, some might not. Are the Democrats willing to say at this point that whatever the final version of the bill is, after all those amendments have been considered, that the Democrats won't have a filibuster on the bill at that point?
Tell me what the final version is. If it's a bipartisan version, I would hope there would not be a filibuster. I hope we'd vote it up or down. I will vote either for it or against it based on what's in it. But the thing is, if we did that, then you have the Republican-controlled Senate, having had a lot of amendments voted on by both parties, would go to what we call conference with the House of Representatives, Democratic control, but with a lot of Republican input. I'm willing to bet, based on my own experience here, that we'd come across with a good piece of legislation.
And I think
I think we have to. You know, we've had cases where there's been things done that we thought were wrong by the police, but everybody talked about it for a day or two, and then it's gone. I think the having video cameras, not only what happened to Ms. Floyd, but the other things, American people want something to be done. Now, I've talked to a lot of people in Vermont. I hear all kinds of, from across the board, of things that should be done. But you get that same thing around the country. That's why we should sit down and have hearings. We've had one hearing judiciary. We should have enough, even if we do it every single day, and then come up and have, just as we did when we passed the immigration bill, have key Republicans, key Democrats, work out a proposal and vote it up or down. I think we'd be a lot further ahead.
Just this one point I want to clarify, because from what I'm reading about from some of the Senate Republican leaders, it's a very important point to them that if they go along with your idea and they allow the Democrats to offer any number of amendments, and again, some of them may pass, some of them may not, but at least there was an opportunity to discuss and debate them. If you get to that point and you have a final bill, will the Democrats at that point pledge not to filibuster because you had an opportunity to offer amendments?
Well, I would certainly feel we should go ahead and vote. I'm not going to pledge I'm going to vote for a bill that I have no idea what's in it. And I don't think any Republican would pledge that either. I think what we want to do, we want something that's going to increase accountability for police misconduct. And that only comes about if you have strengthened federal investigations and prosecutions. And the Republican bill has left that out. Several Republicans will tell you privately that was a mistake. And let's talk about a comprehensive one. And that, I think, can be done. I really do believe it can be done. And I believe it would be done. You're not going to find any Republican or any Democrat is going to make a commitment today to vote for a bill they haven't seen. But I am convinced, just like a polarized Senate came together in immigration after weeks of working, real hearings, real votes, real amendments, and two-thirds of the Senate, Republicans and Democrats, voted for it. That can be done. I know there are some people, probably on both sides, who don't want to cast a difficult vote. Well, if you don't want to cast a difficult vote, get out of the Senate.
Senator, it seems like one provision that divides the Democrats and the Republicans right now, and it's a fairly serious division, is over the issue of qualified immunity, and that many Democrats want to eliminate qualified immunity so that police officers can be held civilly liable for abuses. How important is it from your perspective to have that in the bill?
I think that we see on that there has been so much misuse of it that what is done is just said that things happen that you and I would both look at and say, this was wrong. And yet they say, well, we got this immunity. And the courts say our hands are tied. And one of the things we find that maybe they might tell the police officer, okay, you're out the hook, but you can't stay here in this police department anymore. So they go to another police department. There's an article today, somebody who's basically kicked out about six or seven police departments. But because of the immunity, they just go on to another police department and get kicked off again when they do something. Now, we can't have qualified immunity. Besides, the White House has already said that they would veto police reform legislation if it's like what the House has. Well, let's wait till we get a bill. That's all the more reason. Veto threats don't bring about the real compromise you need. I think that you've got Republicans and Democrats alike who have a lot of experience in this field could come up with a good bill. But qualified immunity, I'm sure, is going to be out. Chokeholds, that's going to be out. I think the no knock on minor drug matters makes no sense whatsoever. We've seen people shot and killed by mistake because of that. But you're saying, okay, there's a possibility. You may have $50 worth of marijuana in there. Sorry, you just got the death penalty for it, and we made a mistake.
Senator, as a former prosecutor, what do you say to those people who argue that the Democratic bill is actually going to make it much harder for the police to do their job and in the process endanger public safety?
I haven't heard any police officer in Vermont, and we have some wonderful police in both the state police and local police. I haven't heard a single one of them say, oh, yeah, we want to be able to do a chokehold on somebody who is handcuffed and can't get up anyway and give them a chokehold for over 8 minutes until they die on what might have been a small misdemeanor charge. I haven't heard a single police officer in Vermont, and I talk to police officers around the country because I've worked with them on the bulletproof vest bill and other things. I haven't heard anybody say to me, yeah, we ought to be able to do those chokeholds, especially when you have somebody handcuffed and it's a minor crime. To give you one example, we had a very crooked police officer in Vermont named Paul Lawrence. He was going around the state as a big hero in a lot of counties because he was arresting people on drug charges. And some of the people may have been guilty, others he framed. When he came into Chittenden County to operate, I worked with others, police officers from outside the state and those I trusted in our state. We set a trap for him, and we arrested him. It's interesting. I was running for the Senate at the time. They told me, because I was spending all the time on that, there's no way I'd get elected to the Senate. And I said, well, I had a sworn duty to uphold the law. But we got him. Now, here's the tragedy of the thing. The governor had to go, after he went over all these cases, he had to give pardons to everybody, some of whom were drug dealers, some of whom were innocent. You couldn't tell which was which, except for one person, one teenager. You couldn't give a pardon to because he was so ashamed of being charged, he hanged himself. And I've never forgotten that. If you say that no wrong can be done, you allow that. To their credit, most of the police officers around the state, their chiefs and others, contacted me and saying, thank you for getting rid of this guy.
Let's talk to Peter, who's calling from Brattleboro. Hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
Hi. So my question was, would it be possible to craft an amendment to say that all entries into the police force would be given a psychological evaluation and another one every 3 years?
In federal legislation to tell states and local communities they have to do that, I don't see that happening. What I do see, and what could be very helpful, put in funding so that states and local communities could do something similar to that. I don't know whether it's a 3-year or 4-year retest or whatnot, but I think those kind of things could be important. You know, we do this in a lot of different areas, certainly in our military and in some of our federal police agencies, that kind of testing, and that may be worthwhile. But I think to get states and local communities doing, one thing would be to have federal funding available for them if they do.
Peter, thanks for your phone call. Senator, the Republican bill is largely authored by South Carolina Senator Tim Scott. And just from a philosophical point of view, he says he's using financial incentives to encourage local police departments to take corrective action, and that providing these incentives will basically have the same impact that the Democrats' ban, let's say, on chokeholds or knee holds will have. Do you think the financial incentive approach, like the one you just suggested for psychological testing, would work for the rest of the bill?
I think that you're going to have both. Tim Scott is a friend of mine. I like him a lot. We've worked together on financial incentives in other areas. But you can't have simply the financial incentive. For example, we'll give you a financial incentive to ban chokeholds, which should be banned anyway. What if a state says, well, we got plenty of money, we don't need that. We'll continue with chokeholds. The chokeholds are still there. Why not make them illegal? Certainly, certain types of weapons, certain types of tactics are illegal at both the state and the federal level. Just include that in there.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Jay, who's in Plattsburgh, New York. Hi, Jay. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. My question is in reference to the incident that involved the police officer with the taser, and what the thoughts are when we implement strategies for less than lethal, and then these weapons are turned around and used against us. We have a situation like the one that took place out of state, and now you've got an officer being charged with murder for what seems to me to be a justified use of deadly force. So I wanted to know what the thoughts were on the way that has worked out.
That's a good question. And the question is, on that particular case, the video said that the suspect had used the taser. He was running away, so he's not a threat with a taser. Does he then, because he used the taser, qualify for the death penalty with two shots in the back, with a police officer then swearing at the dead body on the ground? Then that puts an entirely different light. Does a police officer have the right to defend themselves? Of course they do, just as they have the right to defend every one of us against people who would do us harm. The question still comes down. Do you give the death penalty to somebody running away who is no longer a threat to you at all because you're really angry they tased you? Do you give the death penalty to somebody because they did a motor vehicle violation? And that's where we are. Some people don't like to place it that way, but those are the questions we have to ask.
Let's talk to Paul, who's calling from Essex Junction. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Regarding the economic stimulus, instead, as an alternative for next round, just a general funds distribution, could we focus on improving our nation's infrastructure and creating jobs in the process to do that? Things like broadband internet from shore to shore, all the bridges and dams that are in trouble, hardening our electric grid and to be able to withstand a solar storm, things along those lines that could have lasting benefit as opposed to just sending people a check.
I don't think it's an either or. As you know, I have pushed very hard for money, as Governor Scott, to say we need broadband everywhere. I found out what that was like during this pandemic when everybody was working from home. All my offices are off with secure computers, and their phones are transferred to them at home. For me to do that from my home in Middlesex, Vermont, even though I pay for high-speed internet and everything else. It worked so sporadically, I couldn't have done that. And I think that I was on the phone this morning with two or three businesses in Vermont who are talking about what they need and how they can be helped. And they also said high-speed internet everywhere. The governor and I totally agree with that. And that money can be used, and some of the money we've had. We have, but it is not an either-or. I know when we try to put more money in for infrastructure last year, the Trump administration opposed it. I would hope now that they may agree with us if we try to put it back in.
Senator, the House several weeks ago passed what they consider their second major stimulus package. It's a $3 trillion bill that provides hundreds of billions of dollars to individual states and municipalities to help replace lost revenue. No Republicans voted for that bill in the House, and over in the Senate, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says it's dead on arrival. What do you think is realistic for the Senate to pass as a second stimulus package?
Well, I remember in the first stimulus package, they at first McConnell said, no, no, we can't do this. And then Senator Shelby, the Republican chairman, I'm the vice chairman of Appropriations Committee, put together a very large bill. He said, okay, I'll go along with that, because he could see how public opinion was changing. Again, it's a case. Let us vote on something. Let's have the usual process and vote on it. Most of our appropriations bills have come out nearly unanimously. We've proven we can do it in the Senate. Let's do that and then send it over. Do we need more? Yes. I've talked with Secretary Mnuchin and others. I think everybody agrees more. It's a question of what you describe as more. The COVID is not going to go away. We've seen in some of the places that opened too soon, unlike Vermont, states opened too soon in the last few days. There's been a huge spike in it. So that is going to continue to be there. I think we have to design a package. It could be, well, I'll give you an example. One manufacturer I talked with has plants in Vermont and elsewhere. Today, talking about how they've had to balance what they do, change the people that can work remotely to that case, but they still, if you're going to be putting things together, you have to have people there. They've had to move around their plants, their shifts, and so on. Now, that can be done. It's costly, but it can be done. Give money for that. The most important thing is keep people employed and then get a vaccine, which may be the end of the year or the first of next year. It can't be too soon as far as I'm concerned, but that's the reality.
Senator, when you see Dr. Anthony Fauci yesterday talk about the next 2 or 3 weeks being critical for the coronavirus and whether or not the spread of the virus is going to slow down, and then you see the president holding political rallies with thousands of people inside, do you sense that there's a mixed message there?
Golly, how would anybody think there's a mixed message there, Bob? Of course there is. And the thing is, I haven't heard Dr. Fauci be wrong yet. And what Dr. Fauci has done is basically what Governor Scott has done. Just be very, very cautious. And as a result, we're in far better shape in Vermont than most other states. I think you have to continue that way. I think Fauci, I would hope everybody would listen to him. Obviously, the president doesn't. He talked about taking some kind of pill or using light or whatnot to make him safe. Well, that doesn't work any more than the church was going to have a big gathering and they said they had a special electronic device that would destroy 99.9% COVID, and somebody pointed out to him, if you're just making this up and somebody gets COVID, you may find yourself being sued. And a day later, they retracted and said, whoops, we made a mistake. There are no easy ways out of this. There are steps we can take. We'd like to get people back to work. We'd like to get the schools back to work. And one thing that I think will help is certainly in our state, we have 11,000 Vermont small business and nonprofits. With the money we were able to get in the first bill, they were approved for $1,170,000,000 of loans through the Small Business Administration's Paycheck Protection Program. Now, with the PPP Flexibility Act we've worked on, they're going to have more time to spend the money and what to spend it on. And that means a large part of these loans will be forgiven. I think that's one of the best ways to go, because we're not saying one size fits all. I born, grew up in Montpelier. My parents had a small printing business. What might have worked for them might be entirely different than what might work for one of these state offices. And you've got to have that kind of flexibility.
Let's talk to Joe, who is calling from Eden. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi.
How are you?
Doing great. What's on your mind?
So my question for the senator, first off, just thank you for all the public service and everything. But the hard question to me is, you know, with the CARES Act and the debt and everything, and we're trying to figure out how to pay for everything, I don't hear anybody in the legislature, you know, asking the hard questions as far as not just state-wise locally, but also federally, you know, what we're going to cut for funding and how we're going to make up for the future generations, you know, so kids in the future aren't in the same debt as we seem to be now.
And, no, you know, that's a very good question, and it's one that, as the vice chairman of the Appropriations Committee, I have to wrestle with all the time. I have talked to a lot of the economists that go across the board. People who are in the Bush administration, the Obama administration, even back to the Reagan administration. And all of them say that in the short term, if we don't put this money in, our economy might be so weakened that debt would be out of control in the next few years. What I would recommend is that we do not do like this last huge tax cut that really didn't benefit the average Vermonter at all. What it did was benefit a few corporations that could spend money on stock buybacks and things like that. No, if we're going to have any tax bills, I want them to be things that will encourage employment, not discourage it. And will there be a deficit? Yes. Will the deficit be much, much greater if we don't do this? Absolutely. When you have an unemployment rate that ranges somewhere from 12 or 13% to 20%, you're not getting revenues there. And you're going to, if you do nothing, the debt is going to increase dramatically. If you do something, you can start turning it around. And it's not easy. It is not easy. And I know as we're putting together the last major COVID bill, I worked with my staff almost every evening and weekends, and to be honest, I might be able to go home at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. They stayed there till well after midnight, working with both Republicans and Democrats. What kind of spending do we have that will actually pay off in the economy, will hire people, and those people in return are going to be back being taxpaying members of our community?
Joe, thanks for your phone call and your question. Let's turn to Jeff, calling from Newark. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hello, good afternoon, Bob, and good afternoon, Senator. Thank you very much for taking my call. if I could give an explanation here before I ask my question. But, Senator, I work in a small business of less than 50 employees, and since the pay week of March 19th, myself along with other employees have taken pay cuts because my employer can't utilize the previous stimulus package. I've taken a 30% pay cut since that time, and as recent as yesterday, I tried calling the Department of Labor to see if I could qualify for benefits. The problem is, Senator, I'm a salaried employee whose hours have not been cut, and through the grace of, I believe her name was Maura, the Department of Labor, she tried for roughly an hour to find a way that I could get some help through this program, and I do not qualify for any unemployment benefits because I'm salaried, and my hours haven't been cut below at all, and I don't work less than 35 hours a week. What is the Senate, and what is the plan, or is there any conversation for employees that are in my position that you are all considering?
Yeah, you raise a point. Unfortunately, there's others of it. Could you, and I wish I could give you an automatic answer. That's one of the reasons why we need another COVID bill, so that we can write in things that would take care of you. What I'd like you to do, though, because I'm going to be in those negotiations, would you call my office there in Vermont? Well, the office is closed. They'll direct you to somebody in the office and give them more information on what you have so that they can prepare it for me and for my staff that are working in the Appropriations Committee. Because you should not, you're working full-time, you should not be caught in this kind of a bind. And I wish I could tell you, yeah, I got this automatic answer, we're going to vote on it this afternoon. That's not the case. We're going to have to build the coalitions for it. So the more information you can give me, it makes it a lot easier for me to say, I'm not speaking in the abstract, I'm speaking in the actual case, because I'm willing to bet and when I do, there's going to be a lot of other senators, both parties are going to say, yeah, I've heard something similar in my state.
Jeff, if you need some contact information for Senator Leahy's office, stay in touch with us after the program, and we'll make sure that you've got all the information that you need. Senator, the presumptive Democratic presidential candidate is Joe Biden. He's considering a number of women to be his running mate in November. Biden says he will definitely choose a woman for vice president. Who do you think would be the strongest candidate for Biden to pick?
Not a bad question. Actually, I think he won another primary last night, but the... One, I think he's right to say he wants to pick a woman. Secondly, one of the things that gives me a lot of confidence, he's been vice president. And he served as vice president with a President Barack Obama who really wanted to hear what he had to say, wanted to hear from then Vice President Biden if he agreed with him or disagreed with him. And in fact, they'd meet about once a week privately. There'd be several other times, but they had on their schedule lunch once a week where Biden was free to tell the president everywhere where he agreed or disagreed. And I've heard from both of them several times that that's exactly what happened. So I'm hoping that Joe Biden is looking for somebody who won't just be a figurehead, but one can step in to be president if something happens to him. Secondly, is willing to say to the president, hey, I think you screwed up here, and here's what you should do. And then be up to Biden to agree or disagree. And also somebody who can work with the Congress in a bipartisan way. And I realize this answer is kind of long, but just there's so much to be thought of here. Since I've been here, the two best vice presidents, were Fritz Mondale with Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush when he was vice president with Ronald Reagan, because both of them could talk to Republicans and Democrats in the House and the Senate and work with actually getting things done for their president. So you got to have somebody who could come up on the Hill and say, I'd like to meet with the Republicans caucus or the Democratic caucus or all of you together, and we could trust. And there are several people that fit there. I mean, you have people like Kamala Harris, who has been a statewide office holder and is in the United States Senate. You have a congresswoman from Florida, a former police chief. Obviously, she might be considered there. But the thing is, that's got to be his choice. The first part that he's done on choosing that makes, I thought, show the right thing was say he would pick a woman to be vice president, because whoever is vice president has a possibility of becoming president someday. And, you know, we're one of the very few major countries that has not had a woman as the head of the country.
Well, Senator, how important is it to you, do you think, that the nominee be a person of color?
I think the most important thing is to be the best person he can pick. To be a person of color, especially at this time, would send a message that we need. I had hoped that a lot of the prejudices and biases we see would have disappeared after President Obama. I see with some of the tweets and the actually racist statements that come out of the current White House, a lot of it's coming back. We've got to put that back for the sake of our children and our grandchildren.
Let's talk to Joseph, who's calling from Charleston, New Hampshire. Hi, Joseph. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Senator. How are we doing today?
I'm doing well, but I wish I was up in Vermont and not in Washington, although we're at least getting some things done.
There you go. Okay, I just have a quick question for you. Okay, now the people that were put on unemployment, they're receiving a $600 stipend up until a certain point, which I'm sure a lot of them needed it. I do know some that, well, maybe were undeserving, but then you have your first responders that are also collecting a stipend beyond their check. What about the people such as us municipal workers that went to work every day through this and have experienced problems of our own because of it? I'm just wondering, it just seems as like a demographic of us working people have been left out of the picture.
Unfortunately, in COVID, there are a lot of people who are being left out of the picture, and which is wrong. That's why I'm hoping if we can get another COVID bill, which I strongly want. We've seen what went right in the first ones and what didn't go right, and it gives us a chance to correct them in future ones. On municipalities, some municipalities will help to protect their people, some will not, and that reflects whatever their tax base is. I would like to see the first responders treated alike throughout the country, because I don't know what we'd do without them.
Joseph, thanks for your phone call. Let's turn to Sandy, who is calling from Brattleboro. Hi, Sandy. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay. My Senator Leahy, my question, I'm asking first, I have a daughter who lives in one of the western states, which is experiencing a surge of the virus and has a Republican governor, and so I won't say where or who seems to be resistant to mandating, enforcing various precautions that so desperately need to be taken, even though this governor is saying we're having a real problem. But it seems that because he's Republican and he's closely tied to the president, who seems to be wanting the pandemic to be over and indicating that, well, it's just a matter of too many tests, so it's not really that big of a problem. Is there any advice you can give for a citizen of one of these states to encourage their governor to do otherwise?
Oh, I wish I had a magic answer for that. As a Vermonter, remember, I'm a Democrat. We have a Republican governor, and I've told him several times I appreciate the fact that he's taken this seriously, and he's paid attention to it, and he's tried to keep us safe. And frankly, I hear Donald Trump saying, well, we should cut back on tests, and this is all going to be gone when summer comes or whatever. Well, summer is here, and it hasn't gone. I wish people would listen to people like Dr. Fauci, and who says we've got to keep on protecting ourselves. I think it has been a huge mistake in some of these states to suddenly open up large areas. You see people packed in person to person and not wearing masks. I think the example that President Trump wanted in his, when he's going to say we're going to be huge rallies, nobody's wearing masks. Well, to their credit, a lot of people who would have liked to probably gone there didn't go. That's why there's so many empty seats, because they know there's a danger. Now, I was saying what the president said. I wish these governors and others would listen to the real experts. Again, I mentioned Dr. Fauci, but I imagine their own state. Their health experts would say, you can't open so fast. Do you want to? Of course you do. I wish every single company in Vermont would be open. I wish every restaurant would be open. I wish every hotel and B&B would be open. And they do too. But if it brought about a complete resurgence of it and our state got then closed down completely for the next 6 or 7 months, where are we? Well, the same thing is happening in some of these. I think people have got to speak up. There are some who say, well, I've never caught anything. I'm perfectly healthy, so I'm not going to wear a mask. Well, fine. Don't wear it for your protection. Wear it for mine. And in the meantime, if you're going to tell me that and shout that at me, please stand on the other side of the room while you're doing it.
Senator, given those thoughts, do you think that it's a mistake to have each state setting its own guidelines? Should there have been more of a national policy?
Well, I think they realized it was not going to be a national policy. I mean, when for weeks and weeks, the president was denying there was any COVID as it was going on, and then saying, well, we're going to have a cure quickly, and then saying, well, we can gather and have big gatherings. Maybe we could shine lights on us and that would help, and so on. You're not going to get a policy. You're not going to get a policy for 50 states that way. Governors have to stand up, and they have to, whoever he or she might be as governor, they have to stand up, and these are sometimes very unpopular steps. But the governors who have stood up in both parties, in their states, are better off for it. I'm frustrated. I'd like to be flying home to Vermont every weekend. I can't. It creates other problems. But I look forward to next month when Marcel and I can be at our home in Vermont, but we're going to drive up just alone to do that.
Let's see if we can get a quick call in from Larry in Facetown. Hey, Larry, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm sorry, it's probably not as quick as I would have hoped, but for the senator, I subscribe to a newsletter by a historian from Harvard who works in Boston and lives in Maine. Anyway, she asked the members of the subscribers, how would we restore faith in government and faith in our institutions? And I thought if there was anybody who would have insight in how we regain that trust in institutions, you might have that, Senator.
Oh, man, and I think about this all the time, and I've been writing notes to myself that I may publish at some point on it. We have got to get back to got to get away from the time when my side is right, your side is wrong, no matter what you say. I know in the Congress there are a lot of members, Republicans and Senate and Democrats, who want to work together and have. I've tried to prove we can do that. I've passed more bipartisan legislation than I think any member in the last 20 or 30 years down here. But that means both sides have to give, and both sides do. I have a, because I'm dean of the Senate, I have an historic office in the Capitol, and I invite, and we could before all this happened, Republicans and Democrats to come in together, and let's work things out. Now, that's how when the government was shut down, the country was shut down because of the government a year ago, we, four of us, worked out a solution, two key Republicans, two key Democrats in that room. And the sigh of relief you could hear from both the House representatives and the Senate was, wow, they did it the old-fashioned way. They actually talked to each other. We have got to come back to that. We, in Vermont, we get used to it because we're a small state. You can, I have a listed home phone number. I walk down the street. I see people or somebody, or my sister Mary calls me and says, I heard such and such. And but in the larger state, they've got to get back to it.
Senator, we're almost out of time. There's no easy way to get back there, is there?
No, there isn't. And I think, you know, someone said we need media literacy in the school for kids to learn how to separate facts from propaganda. You have to. There's so much stuff online that appears to be factual. People accept that. Read more. Read history. Read. Listen to objective press. And that's what you have to do. I do online chats when schools are in with fifth, sixth, seventh graders throughout Vermont. Now, they're not voters, but I love their questions. We send them material about the Congress and the government and all, and they can ask any question they want. They give me hope because I hear the kind of questions they want. They actually have listened to history. And maybe all of this will give us some introspection. The caller talked about the Harvard professor. Yes, go back and read these things.
These are certainly challenging times at every level of government. Senator Patrick Leahy, many thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, it means a lot to me to be able to hear my fellow Vermonters, and I wish you all very well.